This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, the 20th of June, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. President Bush vetoes stem cell research for the second time in as many years and pushes for alternative studies. A series of sectarian mosque attacks plague Iraq on the heels of a new U.S. military offensive. Nearly 2 years after Hurricane Katrina, a Senate committee takes a look at an increasing trend in violent crime. And we'll hear from Nigeria, where the country's workers are demonstrating against an increase in fuel price. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Israel has sent tanks into the Gaza Strip and carried out airstrikes today for the first time since Hamas took control of the area a week ago. Meanwhile, the Israeli government is allowing all foreign nationals to leave Gaza and has permitted a number of Gazans into Israel for hospitalization. This as the United Nations announced that Gaza could face serious shortages of basic food items like rice, flour, sugar, and cooking oil in the next 2 to 4 weeks if Israel does not open the territory's main cargo crossing. Israel controls all land and sea entry points into Gaza as well as its airspace. The World Food Program estimates that 80% of Gaza's population now relies on food aid. In other news, China has surpassed the United States in CO2 emissions, making it the world's number one polluter. This according to a report released today in the Netherlands. The report cites the increased use of fossil fuels and China's cement production industry as the main causes for the increase. While overall CO2 levels are greater in China, Americans still emit 4 times more greenhouse gases per capita than their Chinese counterparts. The South African government has issued an ultimatum to striking public sector workers to either take a 7.5% pay raise and end their 3-week-long strike, or the government will return to its original lower offer. Tiny Magija reports from Cape Town.
The ultimatum issued today angered the unions, which have been demanding a pay increase of no less than 9%. Freddy Mohai of Democratic Nurses Union of South Africa comments.
The response of government and the stance that they took of tabling an offer and giving an ultimatum to trade unions that you either take this or we go back to our initial offer. That the one attitude that we must condemn. With the contempt that it deserves, that it's not the way to go.
Union leaders have been consulting with rank and file workers today to determine labor's position before heading into talks with the government. Tonight's meeting of union representatives and government officials will likely decide the future of the public workers' strike that is now in its 3rd week. For FSRN, I'm Tiny Magija in Cape Town.
The wife of a U.S. soldier missing in Iraq is facing deportation orders for entering the country without papers. Yaderline Gerardo is the wife of Army Specialist Alex Jimenez, who has been unaccounted for since an ambush on his unit on May 12th. His military ID card was found in an abandoned safe house with weapons, video equipment, and the ID of a fellow soldier captured in the same ambush. An immigration judge has put a hold on Yaderline Gerardo's deportation orders since her husband went missing, but her status remains in limbo. Speaking to Boston's WBZ-TV, attorney Matthew Culkin said when Jimenez applied for his wife's legal residency, it tipped authorities off to her deportable status. If forced to leave the country, Yaderline Gerardo would be unable to enter the United States for at least 10 years. Her attorney is seeking a hardship waiver. The Dallas, Texas suburb of Farmers Branch will have to win a civil liberties lawsuit before it can implement an ordinance that bars undocumented persons from renting apartments. FSRN's Renee Feltz has more.
Farmers Branch City Council first passed the ordinance in January, and voters approved the measure 2-1 in a May referendum. It requires apartment landlords to verify their tenants are U.S. citizens or legal immigrants, or face fines of up to $500 per tenant per day. Around the time the ordinance passed, opponents moved forward on a lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union and the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund. Tuesday, a judge ruled they had substantial likelihood of winning their case on its merits. He blocked the enforcement of the ordinance until the trial is complete. The trial could take several months. The ACLU and MALDEF argued the ordinance preempts federal immigration law by forcing landlords to serve as federal law enforcement agents. The city's main supporter, Councilmember Tim O'Hare, argues federal law already makes it a felony to knowingly harbor an undocumented immigrant. More than 90 cities across the country have considered similar ordinances, and federal judges have blocked implementation of all those that have passed. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Renee Feltz.
A replica of a 19th century slave ship will leave its home port of New Haven, Connecticut tomorrow to sail to Africa. Melinda Tuhus reports.
When 53 Africans were kidnapped in 1839 from what's now Sierra Leone and brought to Cuba, they managed to revolt and tried to sail the ship, the Amistad, back home. But the ship was captured off the Connecticut coast, and the captives were brought to New Haven, where they stood trial and eventually won their freedom and sailed home. But it's a story for today as well. Greg Ballinger, executive director of Amistad America, says the slogan for the voyage is "Confronting the Past and Transforming the Future." As a band rehearsed for one of the departure celebrations, he explained.
One of the things to recognize is that enslavement still exists today, and that enslavement is in fact ongoing and needs to be constantly brought into the public consciousness.
The ship will sail first to England to help commemorate the 200th anniversary of the end of the transatlantic slave trade, then on to Sierra Leone for a symbolic homecoming. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Three Sunni mosques were blown up today south of Baghdad, one day after an attack on a Shiite mosque yesterday killed at least 87 people. The sectarian mosque attacks come on the heels of a major U.S. troop offensive against what the military terms al-Qaeda militants northeast of Baghdad. FSRN's Hiba Dawood files this report.
Rage has been building amongst Iraqi Shias after a second attack on the al-Askariya shrine in Samarra, northeast of Baghdad last week. Most of the shrine was destroyed during an attack in 2006 that prompted an increase in sectarian political violence as angry Shiite mobs drove Sunni families from some neighborhoods. Now, an increased U.S. and Iraqi army presence in the capital appears to have redirected some of the violence. An Iraqi journalist in Baghdad who asked his name not to be used described the situation.
It's definitely going to cause violence, but not the same way we saw after the first Samarra bombing, where masses and of mob, angry mob, doing those acts. They know they will be hammered down by the American and Iraqi forces. So they would do more violence, but in direct way. Some killings here, some killing there, some kidnapping here.
Iraqis deal with explosions on a regular basis. This morning, two Sunni mosques in southern Baghdad were bombed in apparent retaliation for the Khalani attack. Haifa Kamil lives in Baghdad. Her family is Shiite, and her sister was wounded while at work.
Yesterday's explosion was near my sister's office. The glass from the windows fell in on her. She was thrown on a desk by the explosion. She was wounded in the arm and her head was cut. When I called her yesterday, she was in shock and crying.
Shiite militias appear to have adopted the use of large car bombs, until now primarily Sunni militias. Recently, some Sunni militias have apparently reached a truce with or even begun resisting U.S. troops in fighting against ultra-conservative guerrilla groups and other insurgents who have challenged tribal power structure and successfully turned much of western and northern Iraq into a war zone. Nassar al-Rubai is a spokesman for the office of Muqtada al-Sadr, a Shiite political leader whose militia has been accused of retaliatory violence.
In spite of the explosions that are taking place in both Sunni and Shiite neighborhoods, the two sides mostly agree that the extremists, followers of al-Qaeda, are the ones who are lighting the fire so that they can get rid of the encircling that they have been facing after they were refused by the Iraqis.
Elsewhere, at least 40 people were killed in Baquba, northeast of Baghdad today, as about 10,000 U.S. troops conduct searches, assisted by 2,000 Iraqi troops. The point of the mission is to retake the western portion of the city, which has effectively been under guerrilla control for several months. The U.S. military appears to be hoping it can exploit divisions between guerrilla factions. Thousands of civilians remain in the city. I'm Hiba Dawood for FSRN.
A general strike in protest against a 15% hike in the cost of fuel has brought economic activity to a halt in Nigeria. Nigeria is the world's eighth largest oil exporter, but 65 million people, more than half of the population, live on less than a dollar a day. Many Nigerians feel subsidized fuel is the only direct benefit they get from Nigeria's immense oil wealth, but the government, which spends billions of dollars on the subsidies, say the subsidies must go. FSRN's Sam Olokoya reports from Lagos.
The general strike has brought Nigeria to a standstill, with banks, schools and offices all closed. The effect is further compounded by the strike begun last week by independent petroleum marketers, resulting in acute fuel scarcity. Virtually all gasoline stations across the country are shut down. When I visited one of the few still operating in Lagos, I saw hundreds of motorists scrambling to buy fuel. The Nigerian Labour Congress, or NLC, Nigeria's largest labor federation, called the strike in response to an increase in the price of fuel from 51 cents a litre to about 60 cents. It is the 12th time in less than 8 years that the price has been raised as the government gradually reduces subsidies on the product. The government says subsidies for petroleum products cost more than $2 billion each year. Dr. Oluwole Oluleye, executive secretary of the government agency that regulates the price of petroleum products, argues that Nigerians are wasteful in their consumption of petroleum products because it is so cheap.
When you don't pay an economic price for anything, you are bound to waste it. People keep so many cars, people send people on errands that can be combined and all that. If the price is there, if it is economic, everybody would adjust him or herself.
But workers' unions argue that majority of Nigerians don't own cars, but rely on a poorly run public transport system. The workers' unions say they called general strikes in the past to stop the negative fallout of fuel price increase. President of the NLC, Abdul Wahab Umar, who says the latest price increase will cause more hardship, described the increase as illegal.
Apart from the fact that this increase constitutes a very serious nuisance to the general public, it was also premised on based on illegality, because it was done through presidential fiat as opposed to the laid-down regulations and laws that provide for the way and manner oil price increases could be effected.
Under a new regulation in Nigeria, the government cannot unilaterally fix fuel price without consulting with other stakeholders, including workers. Most Nigerians oppose the price hike, saying it will immediately raise the cost of transport and basic commodities like food. The general strike is seen as the first major test for Umaru Yar'Adua, who became Nigeria's president late last month. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Today marks World Refugee Day, which commemorates the courage of millions of people who've been forced to flee their homes around the world. As chaos and daily devastation in Iraq continues, tens of thousands of Iraqis are fleeing to Jordan and Syria, the only two neighboring countries that have opened their borders to Iraqi refugees. But, as FSRN's Ola Farawati reports from Amman, Jordan has recently imposed restrictions on the entry of Iraqis.
Citing security concerns, the government announced new restrictions on the entry of Iraqis into Jordan. To enter the kingdom, Iraqi refugees must be over 40 or under 20, must prove they have sufficient funds to support themselves in the kingdom, and most importantly, must hold a new G-generation passport, the new passports issued by the Iraqi government. The UN said Monday that the number of refugees worldwide has gone up for the first time in 5 years, largely because of the exodus of more than 1 million Iraqis from their war-torn homeland in 2006. Karim Salim resides in Jordan and works in a gas station bookshop. Salim says he's caught between a hammer and a hard place. He doesn't like life in Jordan and he can't go back home.
Life is getting harder. Jordanians hate us more and the government hates us even more. They treated us in a much better way, but this all has changed.
But the government says the new restrictions were necessary to protect Jordan and maintain its safety and security. Jordanian political analyst Jamal Tahad sees logic in the government's decision.
This is a security decision. Young people in this age between 20 and 40 are more likely to become jihadists and terrorists. After all, Jordan is not a charitable organization, and despite all the adverse humanitarian effects of this decision, Jordan has to protect itself.
The number of refugees counted by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees grew by 14% in 2006 to about 9.9 million, the Geneva-based agency reported, and the 1.2 million Iraqis who sought refuge in neighboring Jordan and Syria during the year were the biggest reason for the increase. Roughly 500,000 Iraqis fled to Jordan and more than 700,000 to Syria, putting both countries among the nations with the 10 highest refugee populations. As Jordan and Syria continue to impose restrictions, UNHCR head Antonio Guterres said some nations had curbed immigration to the point where refugees were being excluded. He told the BBC World Refugee Day, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech, Radio News.
For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org.
For the second time in as many years, President Bush vetoed stem cell legislation. He said he'll urge federal agencies to research non-embryonic stem cells, Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
The president objects to the use of federal dollars for research on embryonic stem cells. It disregards the possibility of new life, he says. So shortly after he vetoed the congressional bill, President Bush revealed his stem cell objective.
And I'm pleased to report to you that my administration and the NIH helped fund this exciting work. The taxpayers' dollars are going to new kinds of therapies, new kinds of science, new kinds of work that do not cross a moral and ethical line.
With Caitlin, a kidney disease patient who has undergone successful adult stem cell therapy by his side, the president directed the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, and the Department of Health and Human Services to expand work on non-embryonic stem cells, also known as adult stem cells. Some adult stem cells, such as blood marrow, have been used to treat leukemia with high success rates for decades. More recently, umbilical cord cells have treated blood disease. But as far as scientists know, adult stem cells are limited in their use.
They really only make the type of tissue that they're found in. Blood stem cells make blood, muscle stem cells make muscle, and they really don't cross back and forth very much.
Dr. M. William Lynch, researcher at Harvard Stem Cell Institute, studies embryonic and adult stem cells.
Maybe we could engineer ways so that that could happen, but right now that's not what happens. They're restricted to making the type of tissue that they're found in.
In his support for adult stem cells, the president cited very recent studies that they're pluripotent, that they do have multiple uses. Dr. William Lynch says those studies are preliminary.
There's a lot of really exciting and important research going on to try and take advantage of being able to move adult stem cells into the lab and make more of them. But that's, you know, very beginning and preliminary research also.
Proponents believe embryonic stem cells are more promising. The cells that are derived from petri dish embryos can multiply, and scientists hope to push them into the type of cells needed. The infinite possibilities of embryonic stem cells is what's so exciting, says Sean Tipton, president of the Coalition for the Advancement of Medical Research.
And that's really the magic of the embryonic cell, and that's what we have to try to use.
Even the federally funded National Institutes of Health has on its website that embryonic stem cells are thought to have greater potential than adult stem cells. But since August of 2001, federal funds have been limited to the research of only about 20 lines of embryonic cells. And research centers, such as Harvard's, is unable to receive federal funding for the embryonic research they're doing. And Sean Tipton says the president's new initiative to fund adult stem cells isn't so new.
The president is put forward this political fig leaf that does not change policy at all, because federally funded scientists have been able to work with non-embryonic stem cells for more than 20 years.
Both the House and the Senate will attempt to override the president's veto, but that override is unlikely. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a bill that would aggressively prosecute civil rights-era murders. The Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crime Act aims to solve the more than 100 civil rights cold cases. The bill was crafted by Judiciary Committee Chair John Conyers, but received broad support in a 422-2 vote. Representative Lamar Smith is ranking member of the Judiciary Committee.
Many of these crimes are 30 to 40 years old. Evidence has been lost or destroyed, witnesses and defendants have died, and memories have dimmed. We must act swiftly to help bring long overdue justice to the victims, their families, and the communities that these brutal crimes affected.
The bill gives the Department of Justice and the FBI funding and resources to prosecute cold cases. It will appoint new positions to oversee the prosecutions, and the Department of Justice must report their progress back to Congress. Emmett Till was brutally killed in retaliation for whistling to a white woman in Mississippi in 1955. Talks are underway in Geneva this week to ban cluster bombs within the framework of the 1980 Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, which was ratified by 100 countries more than two decades ago. Cluster bombs are canisters that can be fired either by rocket or dropped from an airplane, and when opened up can disperse up to hundreds of bomb munitions or bomblets that blanket an area, sometimes as big as two football fields, with explosives. Cluster bombs pose problems not only during but after conflict. Estimates for the U.S. stockpiles indicate that 5 to 30% of the bomblets fail to detonate as designed. They're similar to landmines in that if they're touched, picked up, or kicked over, they detonate. Scott Stegen is the legislative secretary for the Friends Committee on National Legislation and coordinator of the U.S. campaign to ban landmines. He explains the threat that cluster bombs present for civilians.
Like, basically, they were designed to be a Cold War weapon where if soldiers were marching through a field, one airplane could fly over it, drop one of these bombs, and it could destroy an entire regiment, an entire group of soldiers in one shot. So if they're used in civilian areas, one shot could destroy an entire small village. Again, it depends on the type of weapon and how they're delivered, but they can be quite explosive.
The United States believes these weapons have a high military utility, but acknowledges that there is a problem with their accuracy and reliability. But as Stegen explains, it's unlikely the U.S. will stop using cluster bombs anytime soon.
The U.S. believes that it should work towards making these weapons more reliable so that they will detonate in a higher percentage of the time, therefore would not leave these explosive remnants of war throughout the village. The U.S. does not acknowledge the indiscriminate nature of these weapons during attacks. They will be used in war if they need to be used. There is no legislative prohibition on cluster munitions. The U.S. has not signed any comprehensive treaty on cluster munitions, nor does one exist. The U.S. has agreed to clear up the cluster munitions that it dropped in a timely manner, but that's all they have agreed to do.
The ongoing Geneva conference, like many other UN bodies, is a consensus body. If one country disagrees with what comes out of an agreement, it will be removed. Critics expect little will come out of the talks. It's been almost 2 years since the levees broke after Hurricane Katrina and devastated New Orleans. Housing, healthcare, schools, and the right to return continue to be top issues for a city whose recovery has been incredibly slow. Today, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing to take a look at the city's latest challenge, the growing crisis of violent crime. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
Prior to Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans had one of the highest murder rates per capita than any other city in the United States. Last year, the city topped the list, and this year, it's only getting worse. Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont.
In the first 3 months of this year, violent crime is up more than 100% compared to the same time last year. The murder rate per capita is now the highest in America, more than 20% higher than any other major city. Its current rate, New Orleans has 12 times as many homicides as New York City, 3 times as many as Philadelphia, twice as many as Washington, D.C.
Gangs, drugs, the return of the poor to the area, and a struggling school system are what officials say is behind the rising violent crime rate. According to Louisiana Senator David Vitter, the statistics are even more alarming when considering the population size.
We have an annual rate of 75 murders per 1,000 residents. Before Katrina, that rate was 56 murders per 1,000 residents. So basically, we have half the people and virtually the same number of murders. It's completely unacceptable.
Evelyn Lynn is an organizer with the New Orleans advocacy group Safe Streets, Strong Communities. She talks about the feel of the city.
People are afraid that there is definitely a lot of violence happening. It's something that you're going to see whenever communities are stripped of everything that they need to survive. So there are very few mental health resources, very few social services, very few programs for kids, for young people. Jobs are hard. Housing is hard. Everyone is stretched to capacity just to be able to maintain, if even that.
In addition to the increase in violent crime for the community, challenges with the police department continue. Anthony Canatella is a deputy superintendent of the New Orleans Police Department. He says that nearly half of New Orleans police officers lost everything in the hurricane. Many of them still live in a FEMA trailer and then go to work at a FEMA trailer.
And it's really demoralizing. I mean, let's face it, when you go to work, you expect to go to work in a decent atmosphere, and in a workplace has a lot to do with your satisfaction with your job. And when you have officers that's working in FEMA trailers that were not meant, we say FEMA trailer like this is some special trailer built. This is nothing more than a 40-45-foot trailer with floor space that we've thrown desks in, and we've wired with wireless internet, and we're jerry-rigging a police station out of a trailer.
David Bell is chief of the New Orleans Parish Juvenile Court. He says ways of dealing with violent crime in New Orleans needs to change.
Zero tolerance isn't going to work in our community because there's not faith, there's not belief in our justice system. So you can't go into a community and arrest someone, have them released, and then say, now tell me who committed that murder, because there's now a distrust of you. We need a new approach. We need the ability to allow our U.S. attorney, our district attorney, our judicial system, our police system to work together to create solutions to our current problems, not solutions to our pre-Katrina problems. We don't have the tax base that we had pre-Katrina. We don't have the economic viability that we had pre-Katrina.
Local officials say they will continue to ask for funds for additional programs and resources. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller. Free Speech Radio News is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. To find out how you can support our programming, visit our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Tina Gysi and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Antonio Ortiz and Puck Lowe. Eric Klein will be back tomorrow. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. From KPFK in L.A., I'm Aura Bogado.